Welcome to the Wild West Podcast, where today I'm very excited to welcome my guest, newly minted Mount Everest climber, Roxanne Vogel. Roxanne works in Berkeley at Goo Energy Labs, which makes those pouches of energy gel that you see marathon runners gulping down during races. She's the nutrition and performance research manager there, and she recently got back from Tibet, where she set a record for climbing to the summit of Mount Everest in just 14 days. That's super quick. Everest is, of course, the highest mountain in the world. It's taller than 29,000 feet, and so getting up and down it in 2 weeks is pretty much unheard of. It takes most climbers who go on guided trips 60 to 70 days to do it, and that's because they have to acclimatize to being at those high altitudes, and they go in larger groups, and they travel a more popular route. But Roxanne didn't do any of that. Instead, she acclimatized at home in the Bay Area using a hypoxic tent. Basically, it's a big airtight chamber that simulates those low oxygen levels at higher altitudes. For 3 months leading up to her climb, Roxanne slept in this tent at home for 8 hours a night, and then she also worked inside a tent at her office. She described it as like living inside a fishbowl. So that preparation meant that in May, when the weather forecast for Everest looked favorable, she flew straight to Tibet and was able to literally hit the ground running without having to take long breaks to acclimatize during her climb up the mountain. Roxanne is an ultramarathon runner, she's a physiologist, and she's a fastidious dietitian. She calls herself a science nerd. So she's the perfect person to talk to understand how a human being is capable of pulling off this incredible feat and what it took to do it.
I have this personality where it's like, well, if I can accomplish this, let's see what else we can do. And so the obvious progression of that was, well, you're going to end up climbing Mount Everest at some point. It's part of the Seven Summits. It's the highest mountain in the world. Let's see if we can do it.
While she was climbing, Roxanne outfitted herself with a bunch of wearable tech to monitor all of her vitals and her body's physiology, and she's aiming to publish her findings later this year. It's going to tell us what effects this type of activity in this type of environment has on the human body, which we don't really understand. So she and I covered everything about how she prepared for this climb, from her training, which involved flying to South America to climb remote mountains on weekends while away from work, to crafting an energy food product she calls the Everest Bar, to what good luck charms she brought with her up the mountain. She's a fascinating person to listen to, and I hope you guys enjoy this one. We'll hear from Roxanne in just a moment, but first, this brief message. All right, we're back. Now on to my conversation with Everest climber Roxanne Vogel. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Roxanne. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You returned from summiting Everest about 3 weeks ago. Is that right?
A little less than that, but yeah, just over 2 weeks ago.
How's it been?
It's been kind of crazy. There have been, you know, a lot of reporters reaching out just because of the whole Southside media interest.
Right.
So, you know, almost unrelated to what I did, really, because I climbed from the north and it was a totally different experience. So it's been interesting, and it's, you know, I was only gone for 2 weeks. So
right.
It feels like it was so fast. It almost feels like it doesn't happen.
Huh. Yeah, it made me wonder, you know, people talk about how climbing Everest or climbing any mountain really can be this transformative experience. But when you know, condense all of that into like a 2 week event, it just makes me wonder if you can get that same sort of whatever, you know, enlightenment, whatever it is from it.
Yeah. And there's definitely part of me that was a little bit sad that I didn't get to spend time in Tibet and just explore the country a little bit more. But you know, this was something I really wanted to try. A lot of it was because I was just curious from a physiology standpoint. I'm a big old nerd, and you know, the science behind it fascinates me. And so I figured we're going to make this a science project, and it's not as much a personal project. So, you know, I want to see if we can do it in the 2 week span. But yeah, I feel like you do miss a little bit. You miss a little bit of the culture and the history, and just, you know, Tibet was closed to foreigners for 30 years, so you couldn't even go there. And to be able to get in and fly in this tiny provincial airport that nobody usually gets to fly into, it was just like, oh man, this is so cool.
Yeah. So you're not, these last few weeks, are you like buzzing? Have you had a little time to reflect? What's going through your head?
It's been really strange being back. This was definitely the biggest project I've ever prepared for, trained for. And before I left, I spent 3 months just sleeping in an altitude tent and working in an altitude chamber. So Hypoxico partnered with us to provide these. But, you know, aside from that, it was like a full year of buildup to this project. And you get back from something like that, and all of a sudden you're not on a schedule. You don't have certain workouts you need to do, or I don't have to sleep in a tent every night. Like, it's weird not to have a tent on my bed. So it's been sort of weird. I've felt a little lost, to be honest. It's hard for me to just kind of be in this no man's land for right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, let's start at the beginning and back it up a little bit. Why Everest?
So to be totally honest, I grew up in San Diego. I was a beach kid. I never went to the mountains. My family was not outdoorsy, and we went camping all of maybe once when I was growing up. My mom used to say, oh, we'll go camp at the Marriott. So just to give a little background, I didn't really get into sort of the outdoor culture or any of that until college. I studied abroad in Peru for a summer and did the trek to Machu Picchu. And that was where I really had my first outdoor experience and fell in love with it. And so fast forward a few years, and 2012, I ended up going to do the Everest Base Camp trek. And it was funny, I was really young. I was going through a divorce at the time, and I was just like, I'm going to go find myself in the mountains. And I get to Nepal, do the base camp trek, and I'm sitting there looking at the Himalayas and Mount Everest, and I was just like, I need to be climbing these things, right? Like, for some reason, just some chord was struck in me, and I was like, I need to climb. And so I was supposed to go back. This was during the summer, and I was supposed to go back and start grad school in the fall. Mm-hmm. Had a full ride scholarship to East Carolina University. But instead of doing that, I came back from Nepal and then moved to Colorado so that I could be in the mountains and train and start climbing. And I started training for, like, Kilimanjaro. And then from there, I got this idea of the Seven Summits. And, of course, Everest was still in the back of my mind. And And it just kind of went from there. So I was just like, well, I'll do the next mountain and see how it goes. And then eventually ended up climbing Denali in 2016. And
it's funny you say ended up climbing to Everest, trekking to Everest Base Camp, ended up climbing Denali. Like, these are pretty major feats for anybody to do. Like, these could be like lifetime achievements for people in and of themselves.
Yeah. So I have this weird personality. It's just like how I started running. So I started with like a 5K, right? And then I was like, well, if I could do 5K, I could do 10K. And then if I can do 10K, I end up doing ultra marathons now. So I have this personality where it's like, well, if I can accomplish this, let's see what else we can do. And so the obvious progression of that was, well, you're going to end up climbing Mount Everest at some point. It's part of the Seven Summits. It's the highest mountain in the world. Let's see if we can do it. But beyond that, it's also become part of work and part of the research I want to do for my PhD. So high altitude physiology just fascinates me.
Right. Real quick, why the Seven Summits?
You know, that's a great question. And I think it comes down to I was already kind of on that path. I had started climbing Kilimanjaro, and then, I mean, climbing is loosely used, but and then I climbed Aconcagua. And so I'd already started this sort of collection, and I am also a person who likes to collect things. So it's like, it made sense. I was like, well, they're, you know, 2 out of 7. I might as well just keep going. And along the way, I've met some cool people. And of course, on these trips, you meet a lot of other Seven Summiters, and, you know, you just kind of get the bug, I guess. And my good friend now, we met climbing up in the North Cascades, Andrew. He lives up in Seattle, but so we've been on this mission together. So it's not just the Seven Summits, but it's also the 7 highest volcanoes on, you know, the highest volcano on each continent, and then maybe North and South Pole. And so we just keep adding things to the list. And so it's just this ever-growing kind of creature. So
nice. Which ones do you have left of the 7 summits?
So now I just have Antarctica, which we're going to head down to in December. So Mount Vinson.
That's the last one? You've done the other 6?
Well, I've done the other steps. So, okay, to be, you know, fully encompassing, there's 2 lists. So one list says that Mount Kosciuszko in Australia is the summit down there. And then the other list says Carstens Pyramid in Indonesia is the summit. So we did both just to be safe.
Wow.
So it'll be 8 total, but yes, all of them.
Okay. When did you start doing them? Like, by the time you're done, what will the period of time have been?
My first was Kilimanjaro, and that was 2013. So assuming we finish early 2020, I think we'll probably summit in very early January, 7 years.
Okay. So that's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah, it's not the fastest, but it's as fast as I could feasibly get it done, yeah.
Yeah. So these hikes are, in some sense, preparing you for Everest. Is that right?
Right. So everything was kind of leading up to it, especially, you look at something like Denali, and a lot of people will say or, argue that it's harder than climbing Everest because you're out there for so long. It's like a 3-week trip, but you're carrying just a ton of weight. Mm-hmm. So you have a sled and a pack, and it's probably, at least 100 pounds. For me, it was like pulling my body weight, basically. And the weather can be really brutal up there, cold temps, that sort of thing. So, and I think that was really the turning point where in my mind it was like a switch was flipped. And I said, if I can climb Denali and I felt really good and really strong, there's a chance I could actually climb Everest. And then it became real. And that was, 3 years before I actually did end up summiting. So I think it was that whole 3 years I was really like, okay, we're going to make this happen.
Yeah. How do you prepare for Everest? What did you do?
Well, a lot of climbing mountains whenever I could. So I'd travel around and just try and get a bunch of high peaks. Going down to South America is usually pretty cost effective, and it's not so hard to get the time off because it's not as far. I would go down to like Mexico and climb volcanoes there, or down to Ecuador, climb volcanoes there. And then I started dabbling with the hypoxia chamber, and that was a game changer because then I could do these trips in like a really condensed time, not take so much time off work, and then be able to fit more trips in. So once I started doing that, it was like so much opened up to me because I could go down for a weekend and climb 18, 19, 20,000 foot peaks, and it was no big deal, and be back at work by like Monday, so started playing with the Hypoxico whole system. So we have actually a chamber installed at my work at Goo Energy Labs in Berkeley. So I'll, get in there and it goes up to about 12,000 feet, just work in there for hours or do workouts in there, things like that.
Can you describe this chamber to people? Like what it looks like, how this tent works?
So the chamber at work is probably the size of, like somebody's laundry room or like a large closet. And it's enclosed in our gym space in this small kind of corridor that we have when you first walk in, but it's like clear sort of plexiglass. So it's almost like being in a fishbowl. So it's just this little closet area, and I have a couple stand-up desks that we put in there, and we can fit a bike trainer in there. Sometimes we'll ride the bike. I bring my box in there and weight vest, and I'll do step-ups and things like that. But, yeah, it's just this little space where you can simulate high altitude. So there's that, and then the tent at home goes over your bed and, again, simulates altitude, but – some people don't really like it. They feel a little claustrophobic. I actually miss it. I called Brian, my friend who's the CEO at Hypoxico, the other day, and I was like, Brian, I know I'm done training for Everest, but can I please have the tent back? Like, I really miss it. It's, you get used to being kind of enclosed in this small space, but it has a generator, and it can be a little noisy for some folks. And, if you're married or have a significant other, I suppose that would make it much different, which I don't. So, so that's kind of the tent and altitude chamber system. The tent, I try to sleep, 8 hours a night. And then at work, I would try and get an additional 4 hours just so I could say a majority of my day was spent at altitude. So
yeah.
It's like living in a bubble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
What else were you doing to prepare mentally or physically or otherwise?
So a lot of it was the actual physical training, which, again, I worked with coaches from Uphill Athlete, Seth and Scott Johnston. And so they had me since early December, and we trained all the way up until May when I left. But just a ton of volume, a lot of aerobic endurance. I already had like a really solid aerobic base because I spent the entire summer in 2018 just running ultramarathons, trail races, just like every 3 weeks I was running some kind of race, so by the time they got to me, they were like, well, you've got a great aerobic base, really don't need you doing more than like what you're kind of doing as far as aerobic endurance. So they introduced me to muscular endurance workouts, which basically trained my legs to be able to be really strong but also really endurant with weight added to it. So a lot of plyometric weight vest type workouts. We would do a lot of repeats on really steep slopes with a heavy pack, so carrying up to like 65 pounds. And I'd be going, I spent some time in Mammoth, so I'd be booting up these couloirs in the snow with just this huge pack, which is more than half my body weight. So the training was huge. I spent, you know, upwards of 20 hours a week. So I think my highest volume training week was maybe like 24, 25 hours, just like a part-time job, you know?
Yeah.
And then nutrition, obviously. So
part what were you eating?
Part of my job is, you know, telling athletes what to eat. So obviously for me, I put myself on a strict diet. I was always kind of lower carb, higher fats, and high protein before. So I maintained that, you know. I was eating a ton of vegetables. Every day for lunch, I'd have a giant salad that was like a pound, pound and a half of produce. And I did cut out alcohol entirely for like the, you know, since January, I would say. So that was a big change. And yeah, so just really focusing on ways to support my training load through like recovery nutrition. So getting enough protein, making sure I ate really nutrient dense, you know, whatever it was I was putting in my mouth, like it had some value or some benefit, right? So eating cruciferous vegetables that help with your detoxification enzymes, eating lots of polyphenol-rich things like blueberries or cacao. So, yes, I did have dark chocolate every night. But so since December, there every single day I recorded everything that I ate. So I had like a food log, but you can go back and see every single day, calories, macros, what it was I ate.
Whoa.
Like everything is documented, right? Scientist.
That's cool.
Yeah. Nerdy.
And then you linked up with Lydia Bradley, right? She's a mountain guide, but she's also the first woman to have summited Everest without supplemental oxygen, right?
Yeah, Lydia Brady is...
Oh, Brady, sorry.
Yeah, no, she's a hero in my mind and, you know, just such an amazing human. Effectively, she was in retirement from Everest, is what I was told. And I was looking for a female guide. That was important to me. And she was actually really excited to hear that I wanted to climb with her from the north because she had never climbed the north. And so I was... so excited to talk to her, and she was excited to talk to me. So it just ended up being like the perfect situation. And we both got to experience the north side for the first time together. So,
which is in Tibet, the south side is in Nepal. Right. South side is the one that everybody takes, basically. The north side is fewer people attempt it. Is that right?
Right. Again, Tibet was closed to 30 years for 30 years to foreigners. And Nepal just in the meantime had this whole Everest kind of infrastructure crop up. So it's historically been more accessible. It's a little easier to get permits in Nepal. And traditionally, well, it still is. It's just the weather can be a little bit harsher on the north side. So it's more exposed than the south. So there are higher winds, colder temperatures can make it a bit more difficult. And then finally, the most technical part of the climb on the north side is at the highest elevation. So on your summit day, you're basically going through these series of steps, so these rock cliffs that you have to scale. And there are some ladders strung up in places, but they're a little bit sketchy, and especially coming down backwards when you can't see your feet.
So why the north side?
So... originally, I was looking at the south, and I knew I wanted to do a rapid-style ascent. And there are operators offering that on the south. They were offering trips anywhere in the range of maybe 35 to 45 days, which a traditional Everest expedition is about 60 to 70 days. And so that's rapid by, you know, those standards. And I looked into those, and then I also had previously been in touch with Adrian. He is like the pioneer of doing rapid ascents, and he perfected this technique on the north side, and that's the only place he operates. And so, you know, that was definitely something I wanted to look into because I knew he was just the best at doing this. So I reached out to him, and I remember we had this phone conversation, and I was like, oh yeah, so you do a rapid ascent that's 35 days. That looks awesome. Tell me more. And he was like, yeah, we do the rapid ascent, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I'm also considering kind of looking for somebody to try a lightning ascent, which would be 14 days door to door. And, you know, I think it can be done. No one's ever tried it. And we'll just kind of see. Maybe someone will do it this year. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's crazy. Like, good luck finding that person. And, okay, I'll be in touch with you. So got off the phone, let it marinate for a few days. And then, you know, the scientist in me just really was like, I wonder if you can do that. And that would be so cool to collect data on this. And why couldn't I do that? I mean, I've been experimenting with these techniques. I could be that person. And so I called him back and was like, all right, Adrian, what do you think about me? Can I do it? And he was just like, yeah, absolutely. You've been practicing on these high volcanoes. Like, you've done this. You're a big nerd. You'll record all the data. Like, absolutely. And so it just kind of went from there, and everything came together. And
so what are the pros and cons of these lightning ascents? You're doing them way quicker, which in some ways makes it safer, or could make it a safer climb. Mm-hmm. In other ways, maybe less safe. I'm just wondering how you kind of reconcile that.
Yeah, I think the main benefit is, one, you are spending less time on the mountain, so you're exposed to fewer germs. You're not out there as long with subpar hygiene or subpar nutrition, so you kind of stay stronger. You're not hanging out as long at these really high elevations, which the human body is not meant to survive above like 14,000 feet for a very long amount of time. And so once you're there, you're basically just getting weaker, mm-hmm. right? So you spend weeks on a mountain. In the case of Everest, people are there for 6, 7, 8 weeks. You're just getting weaker. You're losing muscle mass. You're losing total mass. You know, you're more susceptible to illness. And it's almost like you're asking to get sick. And most people do at some point. And so I think avoiding all of that is huge. I felt amazing, like, the entire time I was there. I've never felt like I was weak. I didn't lose any mass. I didn't lose any muscle mass. I actually measured this before and after, obviously, because that's what I do. But, yeah, I just, you know, I went in at my strongest point, and I was able to maintain that the whole time I was there. So I think it's safer from that perspective. You're less likely to get sick. And then not to mention, like, the personal, you're away from your family for that amount of time,
right.
Or you're away from work for that amount of time. Like, who can afford to take 2 months off of work? In most cases, no one. So for all those reasons, I think it's superior. And then as far as what are the drawbacks, I think, you know, you sacrifice a little bit of your personal freedom. I did in this case, because I was sleeping in a tent for 3 months, so yeah. I'd be going to bed by 8 o'clock so I could get my 8 hours in the tent. And you know, it's very regimented, and you have to be on it, and you don't get to do a lot of traveling during this time because you need to be in your tent. So mm-hmm. a little bit of sacrifice beforehand, but you're in the comfort of your own home. So, you know, it's a trade-off I'm definitely willing to make.
So you summit on May 22nd, is that right?
Right.
Do you want to just walk me through summit day? What does that look like?
Yeah, so it was interesting, because what happens on Everest is there are ropes that get fixed to the summit, and that's what you follow. It's a fixed line, so you basically clip into it and you follow the route up to the summit. These get fixed by Sherpas. So on the south side, it's like a collaborative effort, usually between the Sherpas from various climbing expeditions, and they fix the lines. Or on the north side, it's the China-Tibet Mountaineering Association. They hire Sherpas to fix the lines. This year on Everest, the weather was pretty bad, and it really impeded the ability of the Sherpas to fix the lines. Mm-hmm. So on the south, they were able to fix the lines by May 14th. On the north, they still hadn't been fixed by the time we went for summit. So it was actually a really big gamble to try and go up on the 22nd, because they were supposed to finish that day. They were expected to finish that day, but nobody knew if they were going to. And they had gone up and come back down 5 times because bad weather would come up. And so I remember being on the radio with Adrian the night before summit attempt, and we're sitting at Camp 2, which normally people go up to Camp 3 to summit and then back to Camp 3. But we're sitting at Camp 2, and he was like, look, You guys have an opportunity here. If you want to try it, I can't guarantee that they'll finish fixing the lines in time for you. You might get there within 200 feet of the summit and have to turn around if they don't finish. And the other part is, because they're still fixing the lines, you'd have to leave later than we would normally tell people to leave. So it's going to be a very unorthodox summit day for you. If you want to do it, you'd have to leave closer to like 1 or 2 a.m., which most people leave about 10 or 11 p.m. the night before summit push. But if you want to give it a shot, you can. And if you don't make it, I can't guarantee you'll get another chance. And this weather window that we have is really short. And, you know, if this is it, then this is it. So make your decision. And Lydia and I, it took us maybe 1 minute to decide. We're like, yeah, we're going for it. Like, we knew the 23rd was going to be crazy on our side because there was only, it looked like 2 days worth of good weather for the whole season. And so everybody was kind of like ready to move for the 23rd. And we were like, we don't want to get caught in that line. If there is one, we should just go for this. And so we did. And so we get up and we leave at 1:45, again, really late for a summit push. But we wanted to give the rope fixers time to make it to the summit. And we go 3 hours later. We're at Camp 3, which is where most people start their attempt from. So we started at Camp 2 is about 25,000 feet. And got up to Camp 3. By the time we got there, it was just starting to, you know, hit twilight. So we could see ahead of us. And we saw headlamps on the horizon up on the ridge. And we knew the rope fixers were up there. So we're like, sweet, they are going to work. All right, we just got to follow them. And so over the next 7 hours, we basically just would follow along. And then if they, like, stopped or looked like they were slowing down, we would just kind of pause and hang out. And we were trying to take our time so we could give them time. And, you know, even getting to this point, the third step, which is the last, there are three steps right before you hit the final summit slope. We get to the bottom of the third step and we see them and they're like eating lunch or something. So we're like, well, I guess we should stop and, you know, hang out, have a snack and a drink. So we did. But yeah, they did make it to the top, like maybe 30, 45 minutes before we approached the final summit push. And then they were coming down as we were just walking up to the very summit. And they were actually really excited to see us. It was really cool. They, like, gave us high fives, gave us some hugs. And, you know, they were like, enjoy it. And so they were gone. And then it was myself, Lydia, and two climbing Sherpa, Mingma and Pasong, who were with us. And we got to the summit, and there was nobody else there, which was incredible. The sun was out. You know, there was a slight breeze, but it wasn't terribly cold. I was actually sweating most of the day. And I looked down the south side even expecting to see people, and there was nobody there. And, you know, by the time we got to the summit, it was like 11:45. Most of the times, if you're climbing Everest, they will give you a hard turnaround of like 10 or 11 a.m. because they don't want you to be on the summit that late in the day. Weather can come up. Things can happen. People get tired. So, you know, it was because we were so much later that we didn't hit that. That was the same day that picture was taken that went viral.
Yeah.
You know, with the line. We didn't see anybody at all on the south. And nobody else climbed from the north that day because nobody else took the risk that the lines wouldn't be fixed. So it was amazing. Once we got to the top, it was just us. And then there was nobody else on the route the entire day.
That's incredible.
Yeah. It was incredible, and it was just surreal to be up there by ourselves on the summit of Mount Everest.
What did you do up there for 20 minutes?
You know.
Take a lot of selfies?
Not as much as I would have liked. You know, I wanted to take off my pack, and I had this banner with, like, you know, people who had partnered with us, and I didn't even do that. Like, I was too tired to take off my pack. I didn't want to deal with it. I didn't eat or drink, which, you know, big fail on my part. And we did take some pictures. Our Sherpas had brought prayer flags, so they put up some prayer flags, as is tradition. And, yeah, just kind of took in the view for a little bit. But other than that, it was just, yeah, I wish I would have done a little more up there. But I did manage to send a text message out to my family and the people following to let them know I had made it. So I had brought this little GPS Garmin thing that you can send a message from anywhere in the world. So, and it's really cool because it shows you on the map where in the world that message comes from.
Oh, cool.
And like the elevation and everything. So people could see exactly where I was at that moment. But it took me a good 5 minutes just to like figure out how to push the button. I was so tired. But yeah, at that point I was like, well, you're only halfway now. So you better get it together because we got a long way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you come down pretty quick, right?
Relatively. So like half the amount of time it took us to get up there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it took us 10 hours to get up and then maybe 5 to get back to Camp 2, which we had thought maybe we would make it down to Advanced Base Camp at 21,000 feet that day, but there was no way that was happening. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to Camp 2 at 25,000 feet, I was spent. I had unfortunately kind of failed in my nutrition strategy that day, which is funny because that's my job. But, you know, to be fair, I had never dealt with an oxygen mask before. And those are such a hindrance to doing anything. Like you have to pull it away from your face and try and slip food or drinks underneath it. There's like a little gap that you can try and squeeze things. And I was so focused and I just wanted to move. I didn't feel like dealing with it. And so I didn't. And that day in 15 hours, I consumed about 200 calories and a half a liter of water.
Ooh.
So I was pretty spent, you know.
So it wasn't necessarily high altitude anorexia.
Right.
It was just that the mask was, and, you know, you were just kind of tired.
Exactly. It was just dealing with, you know, I didn't feel like messing with it. I would have had a better delivery system, like a straw or a tube or something.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Are you eating food up there or are you mostly drinking it? What are you eating when you're up there?
So personally, I had developed some products, and the formulators and food scientists at GU had helped me create these products. So I had a bar that I made called the Everest Bar, and then I had a custom gel formulation and a custom drink mix. So I had all of those things on me.
That's awesome.
I just, you know, didn't end up utilizing them on Summit Day.
What's the Everest Bar like?
The Everest Bar is like 500 calories of pure delicious. It's macadamia nuts, cacao. It's got coconut butter as a base. So it's just like a really rich and dense energy source. And it's also made with honey and stuff too. But I had put a bunch of just really nutrient dense kind of ingredients in there to help supplement me while I was on the mountain in case I wasn't getting, you know, proper nutrition, which I kind of wasn't compared to being at home. But it's also just really calorie dense. So for the weight, it would just pack a ton of calories and I could nibble on it all day. And mm-hmm. It's, oh my God, it's so good.
So you get down but while you're climbing, you had brought all of this wearable tech with you and you are essentially studying your own physiology while you're doing this, or at least monitoring it so that you can sort of study it later.
Right. So I was very fortunate to get one of the very first, they're calling it AstroSkin because it's a technology they use at the space station to monitor the astronauts' physiology remotely. It's basically a shirt with wearable sensors implanted in it, and it will monitor continuously without you having to deal with it for, you know, 2 days at a time, which is really cool. Put it on, forget it, but it would do blood pressure, heart rate variability, breathing rate, skin temperature, pulse oximetry, basically everything, EKG, everything you need to know about yourself. And it does it in real time, which is pretty cool. So you could even look on your cell phone with the app and just see where things are at. So I'd use it a lot for looking at my pulse oximetry and seeing how well it was acclimatizing. But yeah, so I have all of that data. It's like days and days worth of data mm-hmm. that I need to analyze now, but it'll be the first of its kind for those altitudes and, you know, for an Everest summit day. So it's really cool stuff that I'm looking to publish here in the fall probably.
Yeah, what do you hope to learn or what do you hope that people can take away from that research?
From an observational standpoint, it'll just be fascinating to see what happens because we really don't know. Like, what does your blood pressure do above 8,500 meters? Or, you know, how does your pulse or your oxygen saturation change overnight at those altitudes? Because a lot of times these metrics you measure at different time points, it's like taking a snapshot, whereas this wearable technology that's recording all the time is like getting a full video of capturing every single thing. And so just being able to see how things change over, you know, that time course is going to be really cool and at those altitudes because we don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you bring any Lucky Charms with you?
Oh, my God. Yes. I call it my tchotchke collection. So over the course of these, you know, 7 years that I've been doing trips like this, I've managed to come across interesting people who give me little trinkets or things that are like for good luck or whatever it is. Like I've got this, you know, set of prayer beads from someone or this little pig thing from someone else or my friend who's a U-2 pilot, like the spy plane jet pilots, gave me his little medallion. And so I just have this handful of just little collection things that I take with me, and they all went to the summit. So yeah, I absolutely have little good luck charms. And I feel like if I don't take one of them, then something bad might happen. So now every time I get something that I like, it just gets added to the pile. It's going to get out of control soon.
How much does it weigh? Do you know?
You know, I should weigh it, but probably, you know, 500 grams. I don't know. It's getting pretty hefty.
One of the topics that comes up every year pretty much with Everest, and certainly this year because of the sort of traffic jam, the gridlock on the south side, and the deaths as well, is the question of whether inexperienced climbers belong on Everest, what the feat of climbing Everest really means in kind of the contemporary era where you can pay guides to sort of do everything for you, essentially, except, you know, put one foot in front of the other for you. And I just wonder if you, coming back from Everest now, even though you were on the north side, you're away from the south side crowds, if you have any perspective on that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really unfortunate kind of what happened and all of the negative attention it's brought to the mountain. But it's also not really kind of the first time. I feel like every season when something bad happens and it actually gets headlines, it's usually people, you know, speculating that maybe inexperience is to blame or, you know, people just willing to pay the money and not really put in the necessary work behind preparing for Everest, are getting dragged up the mountain by Sherpas and putting mm-hmm. Sherpas' lives in danger. And I think to a small extent that could be true, but I think at the end of the day, this year was just an abnormal season weather-wise, and that really had a lot to do with it. You know, normally on Everest, there might be 7 to 10 days of good weather where people can summit, and this year it was more like 3 to 5. And so when you have this compressed window, everybody has to go for it at the same time, and mm-hmm. it's nobody's fault. It's just, it is what it is, and it's really unfortunate, but I think the weather window had a lot to do with it, and there's just a lot of people on the mountain, and that's what happens. So,
mm-hmm. so. There's also something about the popularity of these mountains. I haven't climbed any of them, but I've heard similar stories from people who have gone to Kilimanjaro that it's just kind of a big crowded mess a little bit, and it's kind of this conveyor belt of hikers and people going up, and I guess I just wonder how that affects what ultimately for the people who pioneered these routes and for people who love climbing mountains is supposed to be this personal sort of spiritual experience in the outdoors.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, and it's something I've observed, definitely. I mean, I remember when I climbed Kilimanjaro, there was this one woman being literally dragged up with oxygen on, like one porter under each of her arms. And I was just like, whoa, that's crazy. You know, like, I wonder if she's even going to remember this. And then you talk about the crowding and things like that. And I lived in Denver for 4 years. And so it's like any given weekend, you'd go out to one of the 14ers out there and same thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to say that, you know, there should be a limit on the number of people that can climb or any of the things that has been brought up, you know, about Everest. But when so many people want to enjoy a mountain, like, who's to say that we shouldn't let them? It is kind of a bummer when you get to a mountain or whatever outdoor space and it's crowded and that. But, you know, I think everybody has a choice. And if you want to find a more remote location or remote mountain to climb, then you can absolutely do that. I've been to some pretty remote locations down in South America lately that I'm like, wow, this is amazing. There's nobody out here. So, Yeah, I think it just depends on kind of the legwork you want to put into it, how much you're willing to do your own logistics and you know, deal with trip planning. But if you want to get remote and you want to get away from the crowds, it's entirely possible still. There are lots of places on this planet that are untouched. So.
And then part of your trip was – part of the point of your trip or something that you wanted to incorporate was raising awareness for women and Latinas in the outdoors, yeah?
Yep, absolutely.
What was the – where did that come from and what do you – sort of what message do you want to convey?
Well, I know – you know, just from going on trips or going to mountaineering courses or things like that, it was always very evident that the female ratio, the female to male ratio, was very, very low. A lot of times I'd be the only woman. Most of the time it'd be like myself and maybe one other female on any given trip or class or whatever it was. And so it's just, and even when I was looking for a female guide, you know, there were like three that I could have contacted. One of them had just had a baby recently and wasn't really guiding the mountain anymore. I knew one and she ended up being injured and wasn't able to climb this season. And so she was actually the one who introduced me to Lydia Brady, who was the final one. So it's just, it's blatantly obvious. Even when I was trying to get a down suit for the trip, you know, or just different gear for this trip, it's like they don't offer these mountaineering clothes in women's at all. So you have to buy a man's suit or man's, you know, whatever. And luckily I have really good friends at Mountain Hardware and they were able to help me kind of fit my suit so that I could wear it. But it was a men's small and it was just ginormous on me. So yeah, just all of those things make it very apparent that the female presence in sort of the high altitude mountaineering world is very limited. And I just love it so much. And I think that, you know, other women should enjoy it too. And so I think for me, it was just getting other women to want to experiment and go try these high mountain climbs and things like that. And I am also Latina. And so I've worked with inner city youth before. When I was in Denver, Colorado, I worked for an organization called America Score. So I have this space in my heart for trying to get, you know, inner city kids or Latinos or whatever it is more involved in these outdoor pursuits, because I think there's just so much good that can come of it. And I've gotten so much out of it personally, and I just want everyone to be able to experience that.
Your next peak, last peak, Antarctica coming up. What's the plan for that? What's the outlook? You're about 6 months out yet, right now, right?
Right, 6 months out. So this one's going to be a big one because, as I mentioned, my partner and I are not only trying to do seven summits, but also the volcanoes and then North and South Pole. So we're like, well, to get to Antarctica is such a logistical kind of nightmare, and it's we're like, we're just going to do it once. We're only going to the continent once, hopefully. So we're trying to squeeze in three different objectives in one trip. So we're looking to climb Mount Vincent, which is the highest mountain, and then Mount Sidley, which is the highest volcano, and it's very rarely climbed. And then finally, we're going to head down and ski the last degree down to the South Pole. So it's like 90 miles of skiing, basically towing a sled to the South Pole. So we want to do all three of those, and we're going to try and go in December. It'll obviously bleed into January because it's going to take us a while, but we're looking at about 4 or 5 weeks down there in the in the Antarctic tundra.
It's a long time, yeah.
So that'll be, you know, I'm already getting ready mentally for that, and like I said, I'm still working with my coaches from Uphill Athletes, so that'll be our next project unless I head off to the Himalaya, which might happen, but we don't know yet.
So what will be left for you to collect in the mountaineering world after you're done with the seven summits and the volcanoes and the poles?
You know, I've gotten that question a couple times, but I'm like, there's always going to be a mountain to climb. And especially now with the rapid ascent technology, it's like you can go and do something in 5 days that might otherwise take 20. So, you know, I'm not going to say I would never consider other 8,000 meter peaks. So that could definitely be another collection, so to speak, but you know, we'll see where it goes.
Well, thanks very much for coming by. This is great, Roxanne.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thanks very much again to Roxanne for coming into chat. For more info on her journeys and research, she's on Instagram at Roxy Mountain Girl, Roxy MTNGIRL. If you want to follow what I'm up to with California travel, I'm on Twitter at Greg R. Thomas. If you've got questions for me or suggestions for who I should bring on the pod, email me at gthomas@sfchronicle.com. Wild West is part of the San Francisco Chronicle Podcast Network. Find us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you like us, throw us a rating and a review. See you next time.